Skip the waiting room. TireRack.com now offers convenient mobile tire installation in select areas. Simply shop TireRack.com for your next set of tires, and at checkout, choose Tire Rack Mobile Tire Installation. An expertly trained technician will arrive with your tires and install them on site, at home, at the office, wherever you are. You'll spend less time waiting and more time doing the things you enjoy. TireRack.com, the way tire buying should be.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, we'll be taking a look at health politics from the ripples of the Trump administration to the priorities facing our own new health minister, Jennifer Carroll McNeill. I'll be joined by David Gillick to talk about the power of the park run, and neuroscientist TJ Power on small habits to boost your brain chemistry. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm good. I hope you are all coming out the other side of the storm damage. I have been in a bit of a hurricane of sorts myself, though I escaped the actual storm unscathed. There have been, let's just call them, parenting issues that I won't go into in detail today, but suffice to say I have been clinging on for dear life, white knuckle at times, but man, it can just wear you down sometimes, can't it? I'm not sure what's more exhausting, the early baby days or as it becomes more complicated as they grow. But look, staying calm, leaning into the breath work that I learned, and ultimately everybody's healthy and happy. So I'm, you know, keeping focus on that too. And we cleared out a big shed at my house that was full of my dad's stuff. And while it really needed to be done, we need to get some remedial works done to it. It can be so tough to go through the stuff of someone who is no longer here and decide that things that they had kept are no longer useful. It's just a tough one. So if it's something you've been through or are going through, I feel you. I could really feel him there tinkering about keeping endless bundles of twine, and I mean endless bundles, and saying things like, sure, that's a great box, and putting that in a corner somewhere, and there I am throwing it in into a skip. But look, he was not really a sentimental man, and I know that he would support the progress overall, and it was also a major workout filling that skip, and I've hung on to a few memorable pieces. Sure, you'd have to. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, from Trump's mass order signing to our newly recruited health minister, Shauna Bowers is health correspondent with the Irish Times, and she joins me now to discuss the politics of health. Well, Shauna, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire.
Well, let's start with the appointment of our new health minister, Jennifer Carroll McNeill. What's likely to be top of the priority list for her?
Yeah, so a lot still remains to be seen. Obviously, the Dáil has been adjourned until early February, but there are a couple of things that have been in train that she's likely to continue. You know, the provision of free hormone replacement therapy, a treatment for those suffering from debilitating symptoms of menopause, that's supposed to be brought in the start of January, but due to kind of bureaucracy and kind of lining things out, sorting out finances and the system in which it's going to work, has kind of delayed the rollout of that. So I'd say that would be quite high on her priority list. Then there's always kind of the usual things that pervade the Department of Health and the Minister for Health's role, which is, you know, getting down waiting lists. They are beginning to come down, but from a very high base. So there's still a lot more work to be done there. You know, emergency department overcrowding. We saw a lot of that in January due to respiratory viruses such as the flu and RSV. So these are things that kind of again and again come up, increasing capacity, recruitment and retention of staff. And as much work as the department and as the successive minister has put into these areas, they've yet to be solved. So I imagine they'll be top of her list.
Yeah. Do you think the health ministry is a poisoned chalice of sorts because you've only highlighted a couple of things? The Children's Hospital is due to be opened finally in June. There's a lot wrong with the health service, but are there a number of positives too?
There are. And, you know, like we often hear that the Minister for Health is a poison chalice, but like if you look at Simon Harris as Minister for Health, he was Taoiseach, now Tánaiste. Leo Varadkar as Minister for Health, he was Taoiseach and Tánaiste. So, you know, kind of sometimes it's where the ducks fall or that sort of thing. But There is some good work. As you mentioned, the National Children's Hospital's substantial completion date is June of this year, but unlikely to open the patients until the very end of this year, or more likely early next year. I think we do tend to focus on the bad, you know, like UHL has been in the news a lot due to the death of 16-year-old Aoife Johnston, who waited more than 13 hours for antibiotics because the emergency department is so overcrowded. But as I mentioned earlier, like, waiting lists are coming down. Like, we were close to 1 million at one point. Now I think we're in and around 700,000, which is still obviously far too high, but that is an improvement. And the thing is, like, we're not just taking people off the waiting list. Obviously, every day more people are going onto waiting lists as well. So I think given the aging and increasing population in Ireland, you know, of course there are going to be challenges in the health service, because as you get older, you're more likely to develop comorbidities, so multiple different diseases or illnesses. And that then increases the likelihood of requiring hospital care as opposed to care being provided in the community. So I think there is a lot of work to be done, but there is a lot going on behind the scenes as well that doesn't exactly make headlines. You know, there's been a move to do a lot more community care to kind of prevent people going into hospitals, because if you're older and vulnerable and you're in hospital, perhaps unnecessarily, you're more likely to contract, you know, a healthcare associated infection and perhaps catch illnesses there that if you were dealt with in the community, you could have escaped and not been affected by it. So there's a lot going on in the service, and I guess it remains to be seen what kind of happens across next government.
Yeah, it is indeed a complicated department, as you say. I think it is important that you mentioned the HRT topic first. I've been contacted by so many women frustrated with arriving thinking, as was promised in the run-up to the election, that come January 2025 they would be receiving free HRT. And while I think menopause is a topic for either gender to take on, I think it's interesting to have a woman at the helm, and hopefully that is something that'll be sorted sooner rather than later. Let's widen our scope then a little, and let's look at the inauguration of Donald Trump. And he has been, as I mentioned in the introduction, signing a lot of bills and making some big moves when it comes to health throughout America. Let's touch on some of those, in particular the decision to remove America from the World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm. I don't really think his decisions come as a surprise for many people, because if you look back at his first term as president during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, his relationship with health and health policy was always kind of fraught. You know, he was an individual who spoke out about disinfectant and sunlight being cures for COVID-19. He clashed with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was kind of his chief medical advisor consistently throughout the pandemic. And I know Dr. Fauci released a memoir after he retired in 2022. And the chapter that was about Donald Trump was titled "He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not," you know, and it detailed the very fraught relationship that they had, how, according to Fauci, Trump would be shouting at him and screaming at him in private and things like that. And because Fauci didn't back up his theories and his hypotheses about how to beat COVID-19, and Fauci relied more on the medical evidence and science that was before him, I think it comes as no surprise, really, that he is taking the steps that he has announced. So the withdrawal from the World Health Organization is something he had tried to do before, but the withdrawal will take effect from next January 22nd, 2026. And this is actually going, like, this is a big move, and it's somewhat of a scary move as well, because global health is so important, and the sharing of data, the sharing of research, the coming together, like, World Health Organization is designed to, you know, facilitate the sharing of knowledge, but mostly to protect the most vulnerable communities. And so the impact of the US leaving could be quite dire for those countries in the developing world who, you know, they may still be battling with HIV and AIDS or TB or polio or various kind of infectious diseases that the developed world might have the money and the medication and things like that to help them cope with outbreaks. But for those countries that are less economically stable, they don't have that resources. And that was kind of the purpose of the World Health Organization. And the US is like one of the, it's actually the biggest financial supporter of the World Health Organization. It represented 18% of its overall funding, and its most recent two-year budget for 2024 to 2025 was $6.8 billion. So I guess the question is, with the US leaving it, does that then set a precedent for other countries to do it, which would be even more dire? I know that Politico reported that the Italian Deputy Prime Minister and Transport Minister Matteo Salvini, he proposed a law to follow Donald Trump's withdrawal from the WHO. So, you know, there's, it's kind of scary, I guess, from a sharing of knowledge point of view, that we could see a breakdown in communications globally, which would then have an impact on the pandemic preparedness across the world. Like, if you think back to COVID-19, I remember in Ireland, we were seeing those scenes, those really sad, terrible scenes in Italy, of just thousands upon thousands of people dying, you know, the bodies, like basically the city being turned into a morgue. And it was that sharing of information that allowed Ireland to be prepared, take preventative action, enforce like social distancing, mask wearing, things like that at an earlier stage to kind of prevent the country from experiencing a similar situation. So, you know, it is kind of, there's a lot of questions around what will happen. But I guess, once again, it's only time will tell these sort of things. Perhaps other solutions could arrive. Perhaps Donald Trump will change his mind. I know he did mention he would potentially consider rejoining again in the future, because his problem with the WHO, according to his speech on Inauguration Day, was to do a funding that the US is paying more than China is, and China has a bigger population and things like that. So I always find with Donald Trump, and I think this is kind of a given, is that he says and does a lot of things, but then sometimes he rows back, sometimes he doesn't. So I guess only time will tell on that one what actually the implications are. But that's only one kind of executive order he issued. There's a few others around, like the Affordable Care Act, which obviously is, the goal of that is to make healthcare more affordable for the average American. And during Biden's term, his administration implemented changes to kind of increase access to the Affordable Care Act. But Donald Trump has kind of indicated he's going to roll back on that. And according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, a record high number of people are enrolled in the Affordable Care Act in 2025, more than 24 million people. So I guess it'd be interesting to keep an eye on those enrollments now, see if that will begin to decrease due to changes implemented by the current administration.
And then obviously there's things that are harder to measure, like the ripple effect on people's mental health. When you've mentioned the word scary a couple of times, and for people to feel a global fear as to what will happen next, changes to vulnerable communities, the LGBTQ and migrants, as well as the World Health Organization and the healthcare of Americans living there. That is hard to measure. And it's that move into separateness and minding their own pot of money rather than coming together globally. And I thought it was just very opposite to what was said by the outgoing Surgeon General, who's sort of like the Health Minister of America, Dr. Vivek Murthy, where he was talking about what the world needs now is connection more than ever before. And it seems connection is not necessarily high on the list of priorities for Donald Trump. But it's something we'll have to watch to see, as you say, perhaps there are things he says that he will roll back on. But for now, Seana Bowers, health correspondent with the Irish Times, thank you very much for coming on.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, with around 9% of the population registered for park runs, Ireland has the greatest penetration of park runners in the world. With 150 park run events happening every week, it is a community that is growing and growing. David Gillick is ambassador for the VHI Park Run, and he joins me on the line now. David, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Claire.
So are you a park run regular?
I am. Yeah, I'm a park run regular. Like, it's funny, like, when you're mentioning there about like the penetration here in Ireland and how it's grown up to nearly, we've nearly 150 park runs, including junior park runs, you know, which is an amazing number. I remember my first, Well, I won't say it was my park run. I went up to the park for a run. And then lo and behold, I was like, I didn't realize what was happening. And I was like a salmon going upstream. All these people were coming the opposite direction. And then someone shouted, turn around, it's the park run. And that was my first experience of like scratching my head going, oh my God, this is the park run. And that was up in Marley Park. And, you know, I got really into it in 2016. I was up there every week and it kind of got me back into enjoying running. Just a sense of kind of kickstarting your weekend in a nice kind of healthy way. You're outside, it's in the green space. And it actually got me back into, you know, regular 5K park runs and then on to doing various other bits of bobs. So I'm an avid runner once again. I've fallen back in love with running, you know, all thanks to park run.
Yeah, that's interesting because I hate running and I prefer other forms of exercise. But there have been a couple of times as a family we have gone to the park run or I've met friends and there's something about it that is far more enjoyable. Is it the community feel that there's more people there?
Yeah, do you know what it is? Like, I think on park run, you know, they're adamant. Like, it's not a race. You know, you can race against yourself, but in general, it's not a competitive environment. And I think that's something that, you know, people have really bought into and created this kind of warm and welcoming environment, regardless of your level of fitness. And that's probably the hardest thing for people to kind of understand. You know, you're kind of put off at some time to go out for a run or run with other people because you don't want to be left behind, you know. Whereas park run has enabled people to kind of come and just run within themselves. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a regular park runner, if you haven't run in years. It's that sort of community aspect to it, which I think is really kind of sold park run and enticed a lot of people to kind of, you know, just get involved, be it with the kids, be it, you know, pushing the buggy around, whatever it might be. And also one of the things I think, you know, we often underestimate is that social connection with true exercise. And I think park run has really, really excelled at that. You know, there's so many park runs happening every Saturday and then they go for the coffee afterwards. And you forget about, you know, people who maybe, you know, aren't interacting with people over the course of the week, or maybe they're living by themselves. And this could be their big outlet each week to go up and kind of just communicate and socialize with people. And that kind of coffee post-park run is huge. Like it's sometimes not mentioned about, but that's a massive, massive element to it. So I think your point about, you know, bringing the family up and kind of, you know, getting involved. And this is what I see as well. I see people walking it. I see people jog a little bit, walk a little bit. They walk fast, they run it. There's various ways to negotiate the 5K. And I think when we put those boundaries on ourselves of like, oh, I have to be faster than so-and-so, or I have to be up there, you know, in the middle or towards the front, that doesn't matter with park run. It's very much you. And that's the important aspect of it, is just getting out and being active.
Yeah, because if you go out to sort of pound the pavement on your own, you're stuck in your own head. And like for some people, that can be lovely to just be them and the pavement. And mm-hmm. That's almost like their meditative state. But for others like myself, all you think is, I don't like this, I don't like this. Whereas when you're distracted by the park, the people, your friend that you're chatting to, somebody you just met, that's what makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, no, definitely. And like even from my own experience, like getting back into doing more endurance running, you know, my background was a lot shorter. So going from like a sprinter of 400 metres to 5,000 metres, you know, I found it very difficult just leaving the house by myself and plodding along. Like, I quite enjoyed having people around me. I felt I would be pulled along. It's almost like someone else is doing the running and I'm just kind of slotting in behind them, and it passes quicker. And it all depends on the pace that you're going at as well. Like some people will want to kind of run a little bit quicker and maybe they've got bigger plans. Other people just want to get out and, you know, plod around, walk around, and that's what's good for them. So I think, you know, it is individual. What we have found, and like even, you know, how it's grown, the numbers that have registered, is that people enjoy the community element to it. People enjoy the fact that, you know, it's the same course in the same environment with a lot of the same people that you'll run with and walk with week in, week out. And people quite enjoy that.
Did your athletic background influence your relationship with running? Like, was it hard for you to just go out and do a little 5K park run and be okay with that? That you weren't training for a big event or pushing yourself necessarily?
I think my background probably hindered me. It probably put a bit of an ego you know, and probably restricted me. And I probably had that fearfulness of turning up and kind of this expectation that, oh, he was a runner. He went to the Olympic Games. Sure, he should be winning this. And that's actually what happened. The first person that came up to me, and he had nothing to do with the park run. He was just a runner himself. And I remember him coming up to me and saying, ah, David, you should win this. And like, I was almost taken aback by it, you know, because this is like, that's not what park run is about. But this expectation, and that kind of put a bit of a fear in me. And I remember my first park run, I went off like a lunatic. You know, it was almost like I had to put on a show. I had to live up to expectations and like literally leg it. And, you know, even that came after weeks of negotiation in my own head of like doing a park run. You know, I'll do it. And then it's like, oh no, I'm not going up there. I'll know too many people. So that kind of probably put a bit of a wall around me. But when I kicked the ego off the touch and I actually just did it for me. And look, to be honest, I was going through a bit of a difficult period. I had retired from kind of professional athletics. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I initially resented athletics and running for putting me in that situation. And it took about 3 years until I got back into kind of running and indeed the park run. And it definitely enabled me to kind of be a little bit more active with a little bit of a goal and a bit of a target and something that I enjoyed each week doing. And I think that was the problem that I had, like, because my background was all geared around a massive championships and Olympic Games or what it might be. And that was an area, like, that was just clear motivation. Whereas when that was all gone, I struggled with the purpose of being active, and why would I be active anymore? It's not my job, you know, I don't need to do this. So it took a while until I actually realized, you know what, forget about all that other stuff. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel a bit more balanced. It makes you feel energetic and feel good about yourself.
I love that. So what's your advice for somebody who would like to give it a go, but is very nervous? How do you get started? What should you know about day one park run?
Yeah, well, like, first of all, like, you know, register, go to theparkrun.ie and register. You'll get, you know, your barcode, and that enables you then, when you complete a park run, you get scanned, and it just kind of gives you your result and keeps a track of your progress and things like that. But don't be put off with that, and don't get too bogged down in times. Like, it's very much a case of, you know what, get yourself registered, get up there in ample time. So it starts at 9:30. You want to be up there a little bit earlier than that. You know, listen to the briefing so you understand what's going to happen. They do a safety briefing and a first timer briefing at every park run, every Saturday, every week. So don't fear that you're going to be the only person, you know, first day at school. It's not like that whatsoever. Enjoy it and be a part of it. And you know what? Don't go too crazy too early. You know, if you're only kind of new to running, start off really slow, start off walking, you know, because you won't be alone. There will be other people walking. You'll get straight away, you get a sense of like, oh, this is a little bit relaxed. You know, because in our heads, we can build this up and we think everybody's looking at me. They're not, you know. It's very much warm, welcoming. It's a community environment. Starts nice and slow and just progress through it. And you know what? Don't get too bogged down on the time that you ran or the time that you walked. It doesn't matter. The fact that you got yourself up there and participated is the main thing.
And how do you make sure you avoid injury?
Again, like, the most common thing that I would say, and one of the things that I kind of see, you know, is that people who are new to running or even getting back into running tend to run too far, too fast, too soon. So slow it right down. Be patient. Progress nice and easy. You know, and even focus on a bit of a time. So today I'm going to go out for a 10-minute jog. You know, at the end of the week I might go for a 15-minute jog. Don't get too caught up about distances, you know, because again, they can put a little bit of pressure on ourselves. So just focus on, you know, building it into your routine. You know, your body will adapt over time. So give it the time required. And likewise with park run, you know, you don't expect yourself to feel fresh and brilliant at the end of a 5K. It is 5K. So ease yourself into it. If you need to walk in between, that's completely fine as well. But I think in terms of injury, as well, a good pair of shoes, that's probably a key part to it. You know, make sure that you're in footwear that is supporting your feet. It may not be the most expensive pair, it doesn't need to be. It's just the shoes that really suit the runners that suit your feet. And make sure it's comfortable. You know, that's what you want. You don't want kit that's going to be, you know, tight in certain places. You want it to be tight in the right places and loose in the right places. And these are the little things that can catch people out. Your toenails, again, simple thing. You know, my dad, you know, literally said that to me growing up. Make sure your toenails are done, because again, you know, your feet are very important when you're out running. So making sure that all that's looked after. But again, it's just kind of giving yourself a bit of time. build it into your week, you know, be it a Tuesday or Thursday, park run on a Saturday, build it into your week, and then socialize as well. I guarantee you there's various people in your locality, your family, your friends that may want to do this with you. And I think that's an important aspect to it, because the social makes you feel good, makes you feel happy, and puts a smile on your face. And that can all contribute to reduced injuries and things like that. But again, you know, I have to say that if there is an issue, you know, get professional help, go to a physio, ask the questions, and work on that rehab that will get you back.
Yeah, and go easy. And remember, as you said, that even a former Olympian and European champion was worried and scared going to a park run, and take your time with it. And look on that, David. I mean, fair play to you for coming through that tricky time, which is the same for anyone who ends a career in professional sport, and to carve out such an incredible career as an MC, speaker, reporter and author is definitely to be commended. And I certainly enjoy watching you on the TV or hearing you speak. So thank you very much for coming on today. And as David said, you can register and find out more at parkrun.ie. And you'll find David on Instagram at David Gillick.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, TJ Power is an esteemed neuroscientist, international speaker and co-founder of Neurify, an organisation at the forefront of mental health, providing accessible and scientifically backed teachings to enhance our society's mental health. Today's fast-paced world leaves many struggling with extreme emotional highs and lows caused by chemical imbalances in our brains, brought on by the pressures of modern life and constant digital connectivity. In his book, The Dose Effect, Power shares how you can reset and balance your brain chemistry with simple everyday habits to lead a happier, healthier and more productive life. He joins me on the line now. TJ, you're very welcome.
Amazing. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the book. Very interesting topic. So we'll get stuck in. But I want to start perhaps with your dedication. It reads, "I dedicate this book to you and the transformational health journey you are about to experience." So TJ, you obviously truly believe that people have the power to transform their own health.
100%. After the last 5 years of working with thousands and thousands of people in companies and schools, I've seen the most phenomenal transformations take place with all aspects of people's health when they look at health down the lens of these brain chemicals.
And I'm conscious that even in the introduction, when I'm talking about people experiencing emotional highs and lows and chemical brain imbalance, that there are going to be people who perhaps have depression, have suffered with depression over time, or have a loved one who is. And I'm conscious I want to speak to them that you're not suggesting, you know, that there's any guilt or shame associated with feeling these ways, and that, you know, with a simple couple of tweaks, you'll be fine. That's not the message of your book.
No, that isn't the message of the book. And I really deeply connect with the people that are navigating those painful moments in their life. For about 5 years, I struggled very, very severely with my mental health. I went through a very significant period of grief and then into depression and struggled with various addictions. So I really relate to that pain someone may be experiencing. And it's not that suddenly you know how your brain chemistry works and overnight you feel amazing, but it could provide some answers to the pain you're navigating and some relief and solutions towards a better headspace for you all.
Yeah, so this is more empowering information.
100%. And it's not to suggest like this is a genetic chemical imbalance issue or anything like that. But it's really important with mental health to consider the idea that if you're not going through a really significant life event right now, like if you're going through grief or a divorce or you've lost your job or something like a really significant life event, that's of course going to be very turbulent for your mental health. But if your life is fairly stable right now, but you still are experiencing lots of symptoms of depression or anxiety or stress, it could be that some of the aspects of the modern lifestyle are impacting your brain chemistry and creating these symptoms.
And you also urge people that as they read the book, that they begin to tune in to the messages that their brain and body is giving them on a daily basis. Talk to us a little bit about how important that is. And do you feel people are disconnected from that?
Yeah, so For me, what basically happened is I was someone that was like really addicted to my phone. It was something that was really a big part of the challenge I was having with my mental health, was this like constant need to scroll my phone. And I started this mindfulness course when I was doing my undergraduate at university. And I couldn't believe how hard it was to sit in the quiet, because I would sit in the quiet and suddenly I'd hear this loud voice sort of attempting to guide me, but it almost felt judgmental, this inner voice, for the lifestyle I was living with my phone or alcohol consumption or pornography, the kind of things that I didn't think were very good for my brain. And gradually I started easing in, spending more time in the quiet, and discovered a lot of the messages that we receive in the quiet are actually very useful messages, effectively from these brain chemicals trying to guide us towards a healthier path.
And can you touch, before we get into the book and DOSE and what it's an acronym for, your own story on what led you to study psychology? You touched on some of the mental health issues you had, but where did this neuroscience piece come in?
Yeah, so I, between the ages of 16 and 21, I lost 5 people in my family, which was extremely painful as a young man to navigate, as it would be for anyone at any stage in their life. And I studied psychology throughout that period. I started with my A-levels at college, then my undergraduate, and then into my master's. And I was really searching for an answer to some of the pain that I was navigating and the particular kind of unhealthy addiction type of lifestyle I had. And when I first discovered the brain chemical dopamine, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, it provided so much clarity over to what was driving my behavior, but then a lot of the symptoms of low dopamine, which include things like low mood and depression and inattention and lack of attention span. It was suddenly like, wow, there's actually like a brain chemical that's kind of responsible for some of the challenges I have here. Then I went on to discover more and more in my research and lecturing all about these brain chemicals. And for me, it helped so much that I had this really strong desire to share it with others.
And I think it's worth pointing out, because it was something that really jumped off the pages to me as a parent of a teenage son who is struggling at school and neurodivergent, that you really struggled at school. You couldn't find a topic that you're interested in, and now you're a neuroscientist and author. I just think it's worth pointing that out.
For sure. Like, I had a very tricky time at school. I couldn't concentrate in class at all, to be honest. And I never found anything I really connected with. And I was one of those kids that just like kind of wanted to game all the time and not really be in school. And it was when I was 16 and I discovered this like topic of psychology, I thought, oh, that's actually like kind of interesting to me. Like, you couldn't study it for GCSEs, but then when I went to college, you could. And it really began to change everything for me, finding something I was actually deeply passionate about. And that doesn't have to be a topic at school, but for any young person, it's very important that they identify something in their life that they find interesting and engaging.
So let's talk about the book then. DOSE is an acronym for the brain's 4 key chemicals: dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphin. So in it, you're looking to provide an alternative route through our modern world, which I found in itself more optimistic than the feeling that seems to be out there that we are sleepwalking to brain drain in the always on tech world, and that there isn't really another way. Sure, how could we live without our phones and tech and all of that stuff, and that we're just going to have to stick with it, whereas you're providing an alternative route to be able to cope with all of this.
Definitely. I mean, it's really interesting because these brain chemicals evolved for hundreds of thousands of years when we were hunter-gatherers to help us hunt and stay connected as a group and find natural food to eat and build our shelters. And they really originated for a very different lifestyle, a lifestyle that was very challenging and effortful and complicated to survive. And our modern world is the complete opposite. Like, our modern world is a lot safer and it's a lot easier to acquire food, and obviously we're always in the comfort of warmth and in our homes and so on. And whilst there are many challenges in the modern world, we've actually got the best opportunity to feel incredible in this world today. It's just important that as we move towards these tech sort of digital based lifestyles as a species, we don't forget about the fact that humans spent hundreds of thousands of years outside, and there's some actions that we can learn from our ancestors that will help us today.
Yeah, it really jumped out off the page also at me that for most of history, we spent 85% of our time outdoors. And now in the modern world, we spend 7%. I mean, that's bound to have an impact on us. So talk to us about these chemicals and how they work for us.
Yeah, so each of these four chemicals has a really specific function. I think for lots of us in the modern world, we've come to understand them as sort of like a group of happy hormones. And there is truth in that, but they have a little bit more specificity in them. Dopamine is basically this chemical that motivates us. So it gets us to do anything that's effortful or challenging. Something as simple as the task of having to change and wash your bedding. It's a load of effort, but it feels good when you get in your freshly washed bed. Dopamine is like this motivational molecule. Oxytocin then connects us. You can see it as the connection chemical. It creates feelings of love with the people in your life. Serotonin lifts our mood. And then endorphins have this amazing ability to de-stress our brain. And there's certain actions that can specifically boost each one.
And what about the dose lab then? Because that's interesting. This isn't just something that you have come up with that you're looking to promote. You've actually put this into action and have had some great results.
Yeah, so we've been running this for about 3 years. Anyone coming through DOSE goes through a really cool Likert scale measurement test, which will assess people's motivation, attention, confidence, energy levels, sleep, exercise, nutrition, like these core elements. And then we'll take people through the DOSE experience and get a really good understanding as to what the benefits are that occur. And yeah, we've been working with over 50,000 people now over the last 3 years. And as a lab, we're collecting some incredible, interesting and valuable data for society.
Can you give us some of the top line results that you found when people made these small changes, the impact it was having on their day to day?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the big things we see a big improvement on is with people's focus. And focus is such a huge challenge now in our modern world. We've seen a 48% improvement in people's concentration and deep focus when they learn to optimize their brain chemicals. We have a huge improvement in what we call healthy phone usage. We see a 50% improvement there. And then another big element is people's motivation. And we look at people's motivation to exercise, which is something we all kind of know we need to do, but some of us struggle to do consistently. And we see a 40% improvement in people's motivation to exercise, which is really great for their brain chemistry.
And these people didn't necessarily step away from technology and start to live in the woods. This is about continuing to live in the modern world, but making sure you're in control of it rather than it being in control of you.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm also in the ridiculously ironic situation of I run a big social media account. So I'm in this place of like saying technology is like, we've got to be a little bit careful with it. But I'm also on technology teaching this idea. So it is definitely an idea that doesn't involve you having to completely separate and go and be a hunter gatherer. But I would say when you look at something with the phone, we've tried so many methods to help people break their phone addictions. And easily the most effective is just developing a little bit more of a comfortable relationship with the idea of physically separating from it more often, which would mean when you're watching TV, you put it in another room. When you're cooking, you put it in another room. When you're working, you put it in another room. And you don't always have it next to you. So you don't always get these quick dopamine hits from your phone, and your brain gets these opportunities to recharge that key chemical.
What are things we can replace it with, particularly when it comes to dopamine? Because we're always seeking dopamine one way or another, aren't we? So what are some of the replacements you suggest?
Yeah, so one of the best things in the world for dopamine is something called flow state. Flow state is when we get really deeply immersed in a task. And all of us as humans have a specific activity in our life that gets us into this state. And it can be to do with your working life. It could be cleaning. It could be cooking. It could be playing sport. And being in these deep states of focus builds a ton of this chemical. And what's super interesting in the modern world is lots of us obviously love scrolling social media now. If you look at your social media feed, you'll notice there's a specific theme of video that's coming up really often. And that might be cooking or cleaning or sport or nature or music or art. The reason that's coming up so often is because it's something that you actually will instinctively enjoy doing yourself. And rather than being a society that's now just watching others engage in our flow state, if we can actually engage in the activity, that's amazing for our brain.
So do you think everybody will know what their flow state activity is, or how do they find it if it's not coming to mind now?
Yeah, I don't think you would necessarily know. Like, that would definitely be something to ponder. And I would ask yourself, like, when is the last time you found yourself so immersed in a task that you felt like you lost track of time? And that could happen in anything. Like, if you ask your teenagers that question, they may have a different answer. Obviously, you'll have a different answer. But you're looking for something where it fully engages your mind. And I would consider looking at your social media feed and looking at the types of videos that come up, because often the answer to that question is in the video that comes up most. For a lot of people, an activity like cleaning can help you access flow state, because whilst it's not fun at the beginning, you'll notice you kind of get this increased level of satisfaction as the task progresses. And that's this beginning of dopamine increasing and flow state occurring.
Can we touch also then on oxytocin, the connecting chemical? Do you feel in the tech world that we are becoming less connected, even though we have all these followers and these online communities? Is it still really important that we step away from those and make sure that we're making time for IRL, as they say?
Yeah, I mean, IRL is very important. Oxytocin is such a key chemical for a human being to feel happy and loved. And also very importantly for us to feel calm. We have this other hormone that many people have heard of called cortisol, which is a stress hormone. And whenever oxytocin increases through the experience of love, cortisol plummets, meaning our stress levels reduce significantly. And we're living in kind of a dopamine dominant world right now, where it's all pleasure and success and progress. And that's kind of a big priority in our brains. Oxytocin would mean real prioritization of connecting with people, good conversations, active listening, eye contact, physical touch, contributing to others. And in that state, it makes our brain feel so much better.
You talk about social life. Is it important that people push through, be you an introvert or an extrovert, and make sure that we're connected with like-minded people?
Yeah, and with social life, everyone has their own preferences. You don't have to suddenly go to like big parties with loads of people if that isn't your thing. But you just need, at the minimum, one-on-one social connection in real life with someone that you care for. And we do need that fairly regularly, like ideally every day. But if it wasn't possible every day, it'd be every few days. And I would say, for the people that are more introverted, that may have slightly lower levels of oxytocin than those that are constantly out and about socializing, one really interesting bit of research by a lady called Seltzer basically studied what the impact of texting versus calling was on our oxytocin levels. And they've actually found that when we text one another, no oxytocin releases in our brain. But as soon as we call one another, oxytocin begins to release. And that really puts a lot of weight on the idea of FaceTiming people rather than always texting them is a lot better for the feeling of love and connection.
Yeah, I love a phone call, but I think people get a bit shocked when you ring now and, you know, unannounced knocks on the door, the front door, are also a bit of a no-go in today's modern world. But I think, you know, the generation that didn't grow up with technology still has a foot in each camp and knows how they should be feeling. But what about the Gen Z coming up don't know any different? What's your advice for them to make sense of it when the way they connect is so much online?
Yeah, I mean, I spend my whole life every week in schools talking with young people. I'm also Gen Z, so like I relate to this idea. And we go in schools and often I'll ask young people, like when they maybe after their summer holidays or whatever it may be, what's the funnest experience you had in your whole summer holiday? And the answer is often always the same. Like they'll ponder in their head, oh, what was the most fun thing I did? Often what they end up responding is, oh, me and my friends went to this park and there was this river and then we went in this river for a bit. And they'll often come up with that. Like they may have only done that once in the whole summer, but they remember doing it. And we just really get them to promote the idea of once a week, socializing in nature with your friends in order to get a big boost of these dose chemicals. And then if there's time in their life where they want to Snapchat one another and stuff, that's part of their upbringing. That's what they want to do. But if they could have one really social moment in nature per week, that would be incredible.
Yeah, it's really good advice. And, you know, less about restricting and more about what are you adding in. So people following the program, I mean, I say this not as a cynic, but as somebody who has coached people, people start out on these health transformation journeys full of enthusiasm and motivation and they're ready and then life gets in the way. So what's the neuroscience of staying on track, staying focused and remaining motivated to see it through?
The important thing to understand is we've kind of been led to believe that motivation is something that just comes and goes, and like it's really frustrating because sometimes I feel really motivated and sometimes I don't, and that's almost random. And from a neuroscience perspective, that's not the case. We are very much in control of our motivation level based on how much quick dopamine are we engaging with. Because if there's a lot of nice natural dopamine in our brain, we are very motivated for life. And if we have low dopamine levels, our motivation will plummet. And say, for example, for a few days, I woke up and I was quite disciplined and I got out of bed when I woke up and I made my bed and I went for a walk, I'd be building lots of natural dopamine. Then say on the third or fourth day, I was like, oh, I can't really bother for that anymore. Like I woke up and I just didn't engage a bit of discipline and I went straight into my phone. I would then plummet my dopamine level and then my motivation for everything would change. So my motivation to cook a healthy breakfast, to concentrate when I'm working, to read a few pages of a book, everything about my motivation would reduce because I went on the phone first thing in the morning. So I would say if you're wanting to stay consistently motivated, it's all about resisting your phone first thing.
Yeah, it's really good advice. And I do think it's important that we sort of show up for ourselves. And if we make a promise to ourselves to do something, if we don't, if we do go, F it, I'm going to take the phone up today, there is a niggling criticism rolling around in the background of our heads all the time. So it kind of negates whatever the coziness was that we thought we were getting from reaching for that phone. So it's about reframing it and having a bit more of a positive narrative running in our brain.
Definitely. And that feeling of guilt, that is your brain chemicals talking to you. Your brain chemicals want you to go up, get out of bed and attack the day. And we really don't want a life where we feel guilty for our actions. And I have this framework in my head of earning my dopamine. Like I love going on social media in the evening. Like I'll go on my iPad and I'll scroll social media and I'll love it because I've earned the experience of that pleasure. I don't sit there feeling guilty as I consume the content. Whereas if I went in the morning and I didn't do anything, but I went straight into it, I'd have this feeling of guilt. So if you can have in your head, I'm going to do hard things first and then I'm going to earn the dopamine of the quick pleasure, it's so much better for the brain chemistry.
Well, it is a book that I would highly recommend. It's a very easy read. Everything is broken down and it'll just give you a really good understanding of how your brain works and small tweaks that can help you feel better. And, you know, what can be better than that? It is called The Dose Effect, Small Habits to Boost Your Brain Chemistry. TJ Power, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, to Rory Galvin and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.